Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, thousands of Salvadorans face deportation in Massachusetts after today's White House decision to end special protections for them. Many immigration advocates say they're not surprised.
The Trump administration has signaled that it is really hostile to immigrants on many different fronts. So many of us saw this coming.
Also this hour, our continuing series about cancer. Today, we look at vaccines tailored for each patient.
We actually create a vaccine just for that individual, because only that person has that cancer.
Plus, the big screen adaptation of the 24-year-old story of rival figure skaters Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding when Kerrigan was hurt by a man hired by Harding's ex-husband.
I would like to begin by saying how sorry I am about what happened to Nancy Kerrigan.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The Trump administration has ended deportation protection for more than 200,000 Salvadorans who have lived in the U.S. since 2001. Salvadorans will have until September 9th of next year to leave the U.S. or become legal residents. There are nearly 55,000 Salvadorans in Massachusetts, including 6,000 who currently hold temporary protected status, also known as TPS. WBUR Shannon Dooling has been following this story, and she joins us now in the studio. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Deborah.
So you've spoken with some folks who are directly affected by this decision today. What are they saying?
I have. And for many of those people I've spoken with, this doesn't come as a huge surprise, right? And that's partially because this status has always been a temporary one. It's right in the name, temporary protected status. It was conceived as a humanitarian program for people whose home countries have been devastated by natural disasters or civil war. But even still, many of these people with TPS have lived and worked legally in the U.S. for almost 20 years in some cases. And so a lot of people, I think, were holding out at least some hope. And for one, that was Irma Flores, who's from El Salvador. She was definitely hoping for a different decision today. She says that just because Salvadoran TPS holders are told to leave the U.S. doesn't necessarily mean they will.
We have been contributing to the United States. We pay taxes. This is just crazy because I don't think people will leave. And that is an issue for this country as well.
And Shannon, what do immigrants' rights groups say about today's decision and what people might do because of it?
Right. Well, as you can imagine, this is a big blow for immigrant advocates, many of them saying that the country conditions in El Salvador are no better than they were in 2001 after the earthquakes that prompted the designation for the country. And they worry that this will force a lot of immigrants back into the shadows. Immigrants' rights groups are saying that the country is actually less safe now because of the gang violence that ravages El Salvador. But senior administration officials made a point earlier today to say that gang violence was not a factor in the decision because, by law, the only considerations are those conditions that are related to that 2001 earthquakes, that impetus. So in the opinion of the administration, as far as the conditions related to those earthquakes goes, things have improved enough so as to not necessitate this temporary protected status any longer.
Okay. So, you know, some people, though, would support this as part of an effort to reform immigration and say, look, we need to do things to make sure that people are here legally. And as you said, the title was temporary protected status.
So, sure. Yeah.
So what do folks say about that?
Well, you know, then candidate Trump, President Trump, ran on this platform of really kind of cracking down on our immigration system and streamlining, if you will, those programs like temporary protected status that have allowed many people to start lives here in the country. They're not citizens, but they have been here legally. Of course, you know, most of those folks are supportive of these decisions. You know, and as of September 2019, these people will not be here legally.
How would this affect Massachusetts specifically? Do we know?
We do. We have some numbers as guidance. For starters, it means that, as we've said, this date, September 9th, 2019, sort of looms in the future now for people. Almost 6,000 people, Salvadorans with TPS, could become immediately deportable. And so these are people who have lived here for years and years with this protected status. If they can't pursue another form of legal residency, if they're ineligible for any other status, then they will be vulnerable for deportation. And the ripple effects of that, I mean, we need to think about service sector jobs, food workers, administrative positions, retail jobs. All of a sudden, these people who were working legally and paying taxes will have their employment authorization stripped away. And secondly, because many of them have been living here so long, they've bought homes, they have mortgages, they have families. One estimate puts the number of U.S. citizen children born to Salvadoran TPS holders in Massachusetts over 4,000. That's 4,000 U.S. citizen children who are going to be in the middle of these really difficult decisions. And so the next 18 months are certainly going to be fraught for these families.
Now, in November, the federal government ended TPS for what, some 60,000 Haitians who arrived in the U.S. after the 2010 earthquake.
Right.
Similar situation. Earthquake allowed TPS status. So wasn't this decision regarding the Salvadorans more or less expected?
Yeah, I think it was. But still, there are some exceptions. I mean, so nearly 5,000 Haitian TPS holders in Massachusetts were affected by that decision you just mentioned. And you're right, the TPS designation for El Salvador came about as a result of these earthquakes. But recently, the Trump administration delayed a decision on the future of TPS for Hondurans. And that country's designation was implemented after a huge hurricane hit that country. And so I think some people were sort of really hoping against hope that maybe the decision for El Salvador would at least get kicked down the can a little bit. But obviously, that's not what happened today.
Now, a statement that was sent to lawmakers from DHS says, quote, only Congress can legislate a permanent solution. And it goes on to say that this 18-month delayed termination of TPS will allow Congress time to craft a potential solution here. And from the Massachusetts delegation, we heard from Congressman McGovern, who said that today's decision, quote, punishes innocent families to score political points. And he actually helped draft the original legislation regarding temporary protected status. Let's hear what he had to say today.
That law basically says that protection is what we need to be focused on more than duration. In other words, if the conditions are such that it is dangerous to send people back, then they ought to continue to be able to be provided safe haven in this country.
Now, Congressman McGovern says he will work with his colleagues to fight this. What might Congress do about this, Shannon?
Well, by law, only Congress can legislate a plan that would bestow any sort of permanent status to non-U.S. citizens. And so we've heard this same call for Congress to act for a permanent solution for so-called Dreamers. And those are the young people whose parents brought them to the U.S. illegally. Of course, we've not seen much progress out of Washington, D.C. as of yet, so it remains to be seen.
WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling talking with us about the White House decision today to end temporary protected status for Salvadorans living in the United States. Shannon, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Imagine cancer treatment, custom-made just for you and based on your cancer tumor's DNA. Some Boston scientists, including Nir Hacohen of Massachusetts General Hospital and the Broad Institute, recently showed that that is possible. Joining us, as she does most Mondays, is Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health Blog. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey there, Deb. And yes, this week, WBUR is doing a final run of stories in our year-long series called This Moment in Cancer. So for today's Common Health, why don't we start with my first piece in the series? It's on a personal vaccine to fight cancer.
Okay, sounds great. Let's listen, and then we'll follow up with you in a few minutes. Here's Carrie's piece.
Martha Pfeiffer knew she was at high risk for melanoma, a potentially deadly skin cancer.
I, you know, had a gazillion sunburns as a kid. It was sort of the classic thing my poor mother tried and tried.
In 2012, she felt a new mole on the back of her arm.
And I said, I don't remember that. And I looked at it. I didn't think much of it, and I didn't go running right in. But sure enough, that one turned out to be the one that I got the call about.
The mole was melanoma. Pfeiffer, a writer and editor who lives in Stowe, Massachusetts, had surgery to remove the tumor and the lymph nodes under her arm. A couple of years later, more melanoma turned up and she needed more surgery. Not an uncommon course of events so far, but now it gets futuristic. She qualified for a study at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute that began by taking cells from her tumor to analyze their DNA.
And then they did a genetic mapping of the cells, and they were able to isolate the mutated cells that were specific to the melanoma. And that's where the cooking comes in.
The cooking uses a scientific recipe that was published recently in the journal Nature. You take those unique tumor mutations and you use prediction algorithms to choose about 20 of them as likely to be your best targets. Then you make a vaccine that trains the patient's immune system to attack only cells with those targets. The targets are called neoantigens. Neo because they're new. They exist only on the tumor. Finally, you add a booster that stimulates the patient's immune response.
We actually create and synthesize a vaccine just for that individual. So it never existed anywhere else in the world and will never again because only that person has that cancer.
Nir Hacohen says you then inject the vaccine into the patient's arms or legs multiple times. And if all goes well, the patient's own immune cells will hunt down the tumor cells they're now trained to recognize, even if the cancer has spread.
When they find the tumor or any piece of the tumor, they'll start to attack it. And the hope is to be able to get this vaccine to work strongly enough to completely eliminate the tumor, not to just kill a little bit of it.
Familiar vaccines like the shots against measles or chickenpox also train our own immune system to recognize and kill an invader. But this personal vaccine is what's called a therapeutic vaccine. It treats an illness rather than preventing it. For decades, the quest for a therapeutic vaccine against cancer has frustrated researchers. Dr. Catherine Wu at Dana-Farber and the Broad Institute says even a couple of years ago, cancer vaccines did not look good.
When I was a postdoc, all the literature was about how vaccines didn't work. There were plenty of studies, clinical trials that could see laboratory evidence of immune responses, but it didn't do anything for the patients.
Now, cancer vaccines are looking more promising. There's been dramatic progress on analyzing tumor DNA and on treatments that harness the patient's own immune system to fight cancer. Traditional cancer treatments like chemotherapy can cause harsh side effects because they attack healthy cells along with the cancer. But a personal cancer vaccine is so precisely targeted that Martha Pfeiffer says the side effects were no worse than a mild flu.
Yeah, I was, you know, sitting in the infusion center and always so apologetic to people that I was having it so easy.
Dr. Glenn Dranoff of Novartis is a longtime leader in cancer vaccines. He says these personal vaccines successfully combine the power of cancer genetics with new insights into the immune system.
So the work is scientifically very compelling.
It's a novel approach, he says, an elegant proof of concept. But
whether or not that's going to translate into better outcomes for cancer patients is going to require significant more study and clinical testing.
That will take extensive clinical trials. It also remains to be seen how much personal cancer vaccines could cost. Some other new cancer treatments run hundreds of thousands of dollars. Clinical trials are now underway to try this type of personal vaccine for lung and bladder cancer and glioblastoma, the brain cancer. So interest is high, but these are early days. Martha Pfeiffer was one of just 6 melanoma patients in the 2-year study that was published in Nature. Her scans have remained clear so far, but she has no guarantee the cancer won't recur.
You know, I'm going on the assumption that this is working, but people say to you, oh, did the vaccine work? And my response is, you only know if it doesn't work, really.
Whatever happens, Pfeiffer is a pioneer patient for a new mode of cancer treatment.
You're beginning to see how scientists have cracked the code that distinguishes individual cancers and the individual immune system on a patient-by-patient basis.
And that's a momentous change, says Jesse Bohm, the associate director of the Broad Institute's cancer program.
historically, cancer's been treated based on the part of the body it's come from. We've moved into treating cancer based on grouping patients, often within tumor types. But we even know that most patients, even that look roughly similar, don't respond in the same way. And so you have to make it personal.
Bohm says, until now, it didn't look possible to develop a new drug for every single patient.
The authors have shown that you could produce a drug and deliver it right back to that patient. It's the stuff you would have fantasized about a decade ago.
In fact, Hacohen says, he and Wu were fantasizing about this a decade ago in many a late-night husband and wife talk about what it would take to really eliminate a cancer. Now, it's sometimes a dinner table topic with their three kids.
For example, the first day that we saw an immune response to the first vaccine we gave for the first patient, kind of an exciting time. And of course, the kids were like, so you cured cancer? We're like, no.
Wu and Hacohen and others have co-founded a biotech company called Neon Therapeutics that's raised more than $160 million to develop the personal vaccines for market. Other researchers and companies are also pursuing personal cancer vaccines.
That piece from Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, who is now with me in the studio. So, Carrie, one follow-up question that comes to mind here. Martha Pfeiffer was one of just six patients in that study. How'd the other patients do?
Well, the researchers say all six patients had robust and consistent immune responses to these vaccines. So that was encouraging. And they report that of the six patients, four had no recurrence of their melanoma, and this is 2 years out. And two who did have a recurrence were then treated with immunotherapy. That's a different sort of drug that works to kind of sick the patient's own immune system against the cancer. And those patients also beat down their tumors. Here's Catherine Wu, again, of Dana-Farber and the Broad Institute.
The key thing is just this is an early trial. So I think people always want to jump and say, is this it? You know, and I think it's... Again, as a version 1.0, we're delighted, right? Like, it was like a really hard thing to put together, and we got responses, and the patients are doing well, and they're alive, and we're so happy.
And I'm always happy when there's good cancer news, but there's much, much more to do. And Wu and the other researchers say it's likely that, as with those two patients who needed some more treatment, these personal vaccines could work best as part of some combination treatment.
But isn't that what so much cancer treatment is these days, a combination of different treatment?
Yes, yes. It's very often a combination. And as Nir Hacohen says in the journal Nature, you can think of this personal vaccine as sort of like the steering wheel that guides the immune response against the tumor. And then for your combination, you might want to take off the brakes by using one of these new immunotherapy drugs that are called checkpoint inhibitors. People always describe them as taking off the brakes of your own immune system and unleashing it against the tumor.
You know, Carrie, we've heard a lot about these more personalized approaches to medicine and this pushback to a one-size-fits-all kind of thing. But this sounds like it's taking that whole concept to a new level. Is it different?
Well, so first of all, you're right. Like, one of the biggest trends in medicine is called precision medicine or personalized medicine. And it's all about using the patient's DNA. You know, as we get better, dramatically faster and cheaper tools for analyzing DNA, you use the patient's DNA to choose the best treatment or the best dosage or whatever you're going to do. But what's so striking and different about this idea of a personal cancer vaccine is that it's so customized. Like, it's not just choosing from among some pre-existing options or adjusting them. It's actually taking the measure of a specific patient's tumor and then in real time, which is actually weeks at this point, but it's basically, you know, you're doing it in real time. You're making their medicine.
Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog, which is where you can find all the stories in our year-long series, This Moment in Cancer. There's a link to the series from our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thanks as always.
Welcome.
Stay with us. Coming up, we sit down with former Boston School Committee Chair Michael O'Neill. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Wow. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. After 5 years heading the Boston School Committee, Chair Michael O'Neill has decided to step aside. O'Neill will no longer lead the panel, but he will remain a school committee member under the leadership of his successor, Michael LeCanto. O'Neill's move comes at a critical time for Boston schools, which have just weathered some controversies, most recently the plans to change school start times. Well, joining us in studio to talk about that and other BPS issues is Michael O'Neill. Thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon, Deborah.
So in the 5 years that you've been chair, you've worked under three superintendents and two mayors. Why did you decide that now was the time to step down from a leadership post on the committee?
Well, I think exactly for that reason. We now have stability both at the city and the district level. And it was an honor to lead the committee for 5 years. We went through some important changes, but now that Mayor Walsh is beginning his second term and now that Superintendent Chang is 2.5 years into his 5-year contract, I felt the stability was there, that it was time for that to happen. When I combine that with being very busy in my day job at Agency 451 and having two stepchildren who are doing semesters abroad, it was time for the family, for work, and for the school committee, for someone else to take that leadership role.
So it wasn't like it's time for Mayor Walsh and Superintendent Chang to have more of a say here and let their folks be in charge, because you were really appointed under former Mayor Menino.
I was, but I was also very honored to be appointed to a new 4-year term last January by Mayor Walsh. And I've worked very closely with he and his team for the past 4 years. And I would not have stayed in the role if I did not believe completely in what he was doing and the support that he was giving us for the Boston Public Schools.
Now, you, I believe, were the only BPS graduate on the committee. Is that right?
We have one other as well. Ms. Jerry Robinson is a graduate of the old Girls Latin, now Boston Latin Academy.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, how does that affect decision-making on the committee when someone's actually been through the Boston public school system?
Well, it has been a few years since I graduated, as you can see by the few gray hairs. So I do try to be cognizant that things are very different. But certain memories do last. I went from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, both at the Joseph B. Manning and Jamaica Plain and Boston Latin. And that does shape some of the things in how you view the district and how we can continue to improve.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that have come up, particularly the controversy most recently about school start times. There were supposed to be changes to several schools in the district, dozens of schools, but parents and civil rights groups and local leaders got very upset about how quickly that went through the committee, unanimously through the committee. And then that changed. So the committee decided, and Tommy Chang, the superintendent, decided that he would take back that plan to change the start times. Why do you think the committee moved too quickly to approve the changes in the first place?
Great question, because this has been an area that a lot of folks have focused in on. And we have to remember the difference between policy and implementation. So the school committee is a policy-making board, and we set the policy for the district. We hire a superintendent to implement the policy. We approve a budget that allows that policy to be reached, and we evaluate the superintendent on the policy goals. So one of the biggest complaints we have had from parents the past few years is about start time. Folks didn't like the lateness of the hour that a lot of the elementary students were getting out. And we're concerned also about high school students, that they should be starting later. All the scientific studies show that high school students should be starting later. Right. So we originally looked at this in December 2016, put it on hold for a year while the district went out, held a number of community meetings, did a survey, et cetera, came back. We approved the policy. The policy that we approved said the majority of our secondary school students should start after 8 a.m. The majority of our elementary school students should finish before 4 p.m. That we should protect our most fragile students, and we should reinvest back into the district. That policy still holds, and we've actually received a lot of compliments from parents on that policy. The concern was over the implementation. And Superintendent Chang put out a proposal to the community that shifted around a lot of the start times. And we heard four main pieces of feedback from that proposal, that implementation plan. The first was concern by parents who moved to a 7:15 a.m. start time for elementary. And secondarily, the result of the end of day was now we'd have some schools end about 1:15.
Right.
And what that means to families. The second was concern over schools that changed more than 90 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so some went from 9:30 to 7:15, et cetera.
Right. But because we're limited, I just want to get your reaction. How should it have been done differently?
Well, I think what the superintendent did, we had a number of community meetings the week after a long school committee meeting. And the school committee members attended. We were across the district and listened. And what we did was work with the superintendent. He put it on hold for a year. Mm-hmm. And he's going to work on a plan that hopefully will allow schools to have more input into it, maybe somewhat similar to the student assignment plan of where parents pick their first choice, second choice, third choice. Is there a way we can work on schools saying what their preference is? Everyone wants 8 to 8:30, but not every school can have it. So what's their second choice? Is it to be an earlier community or a later community? Mm-hmm. Let's build support on a school-by-school basis and then rerun the run the proposal.
So the ideals are the same, that the times need to change, but everybody's going to need to compromise because there just isn't enough a way to give everyone what they will probably want.
Well, we're already spending $110 million on transportation. And quite frankly, every dollar we spend on transportation is dollars that we're not spending in a classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will continue to look at this, but it's going to be a ways out now, and we're going to have a lot more opportunity for community involvement, and that's the right thing to have happen.
Was this controversy over school start times a factor at all in your decision to leave as chair of the school committee?
I will be facetious and say yes, it was, because I originally planned to announce it at the December 14th meeting and didn't announce it because that was the one that went till 1:02 in the morning because we had so many parents there. I had actually decided this with my family during the summer, and it was a promise I made to them during the summer.
You know, there are folks who said that they haven't seen a mobilization of Boston parents like this one in years, many, many years. Were you surprised by the reaction to this?
No, we knew that there was not going to be one solution that was going to satisfy everyone. We knew that from the surveys. Even on an individual school basis, there was no one time that everyone wanted. And so we knew that there would be concerns. The amount of feedback was a bit surprising, but that's good. I'm not concerned about this. These are parents who want to engage with Boston Public Schools. Right now, we have about 75% of the school-age children in Boston choose Boston Public Schools. We want more. I'm a businessman. We want larger share of market. Mm-hmm. And if parents are engaged in fighting for the schools, that's a good thing.
You want more alums on that school committee.
Absolutely. Well, we want more parents choosing Boston Public Schools first. And the fact that folks are willing to fight for their schools and their communities, that's a good thing.
Another controversy that happened while you were leading the school committee was this audit, and Boston paid the IRS about $1 million after a federal audit of 16 schools showed mismanagement, poor record keeping, like paying employee stipends under the table and failing to deduct Medicare taxes from payroll. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the overall city payment to the IRS was $1 million, but for the Boston Public Schools, it was actually only $32,000, of which about $2,000 was penalties and $30,000 was back taxes. This was the IRS, as part of an overall city audit, looked at about 16 accounts in schools. The school activity accounts that headmasters and principals keep to put trip fees in and things like that, and then to pay out the bus providers for trips. And so, as an example, East Boston High School paid $600 to Paul Revere Transportation for a bus trip. But they didn't collect a 1099 from them because they believed it was approved vendor of the city. The city must have the 1099.
Right.
Well, that was a $100 fee that was charged. Mm-hmm. So that, and then they also paid, the school leaders paid some teachers through this account for being tutors on exams or proctors on exams or coaches or that type of thing. And the IRS said, you have to pay the withholding fees on it. I think when the superintendent was first given a heads up by the city, he did the appropriate thing. He jumped in immediately and stopped all the student activity accounts across the district. He sent the school leaders a letter saying that this issue had been flagged. He did training in August for about 300 school leaders, lead teachers, et cetera. And then it was only at the end of the IRS audit when the city finally settled that it came to light. And he made one mistake. He did not mention it to me as chair of the school committee.
Well, isn't that a big mistake? And also, you know, this didn't come out until after the election, essentially. So there are many folks who are concerned about the timing of when the results of that audit became clear.
Yes. And at the same token, the superintendent stood in front of about 300 to 400 school leaders. He put it in a memo that as a result in June of last year, as a result of an IRS audit, the following findings have happened. This was not something he was trying to hide. He was trying to move immediately when he saw an issue and correct it. In retrospect, he should have told me. He should have informed the committee. he and I and the vice chair, Dean Coleman, discussed it with him. He apologized. We accepted his apology. We move forward. I have to say, as superintendent of schools in Boston, I'm not sure which job is more complex, that or mayor of Boston.
Right.
It's a moving job with a lot of parts. And he's working as hard as he can, and I think he handled it appropriately. But I did accept his apology for not informing us, and we move forward.
Biggest challenge facing the school committee in the year ahead?
I would say three things. We're going to be looking at grade configuration. Right now, we have approximately 20 configurations in the system. We have schools that are K to 5, K to 6, K to 8. We have middle schools. We have high schools that are 9 through 12, 7 through 12. We have other schools that are K to 3. All of those various configurations create confusion for parents and create a lot of transitions. And when we look at when we're losing students, it's during those transition points because parents want certainty. And so we're looking at cutting down those number of configurations.
Maybe no middle school.
Yes, we may be a system that is predominantly K to 6 and 7 to 12 and K to 8, 9 through 12, because parents do want options. Mm. You talk to parents of a middle schooler, some parents don't want their child in a high school when they're in 7th grade. Other parents don't want their child with kindergartens when they're in 7th grade. So we need to have a range of options in the district, but what we have right now is too confusing, creates too many transitions, and quite frankly causes us to lose students when parents want certainty.
All right, Michael O'Neill, we're out of time. Former chair of the Boston School Committee, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Deborah.
Stay with us. Coming up, a close look at the NCAA ahead of tonight's big championship game. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The college football championship game takes place in Atlanta tonight. Number 3 Georgia faces number 4 Alabama. President Trump is even expected at the game. Aside from all the cheering fans, college sports attract a lot of money, which can cause a lot of problems. NPR's Only a Game explored the darker side of college sports in an hour-long special show titled Power, Money, and Corruption, the story of the NCAA. Martin Kessler and Shira Springer helped write, report, and produce the show, and they're with me in the studio. Hello to both of you.
Hello, Deb.
Hi, Deb.
So, Shira, let's start with the money. Schools that are athletic powerhouses make more than $100 million a year off their sports programs, and the college sports industry brings in about $10 billion a year in annual revenue. How does that affect the overall landscape?
Yeah, well, the root of the problem is clearly all the money that's out there, and that's where you get all the opportunity for corruption and exploitation. It's really about who gets the money. And you know who gets the money? The schools and the coaches. Now, let's be clear here. The athletes do get scholarships. The NCAA likes to talk about how schools annually provide $2.9 billion in athletic scholarships to 150,000 athletes. But consider this. Georgia coach Kirby Smart stands to collect $1.45 million in bonuses because his team is appearing in the national championship game. And that's on top of the nearly $4 million he already makes. So you've got these coaches who are making a lot, these colleges that are making a lot, and there's a real power imbalance, and that leaves the players vulnerable. It's also worth mentioning that their scholarships are not guaranteed for 4 years. They have to be renewed every year. And that's another part of the power money imbalance, because if a better player comes in at your position or if you get injured, you could be out of your scholarship and, quite frankly, possibly out of a college education as well.
And Martin, you looked at this from the student athletes' perspective. What did they say?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, just as Shira mentioned, they're starting to sort of notice this power imbalance more and more. And you know, we profiled one player on this episode. His name was Kyle Hardrick, and
this was so heartbreaking. It was absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah, he was a former University of Oklahoma basketball player, and I think his story sort of illustrates, you know, that this power imbalance can lead to really sad outcomes. And what happened to him was he was this top recruit, but he ended up getting injured his freshman year, and ultimately ended up losing his scholarship. And this was a kid who was, you know, had such promise. And he ended up dropping out of college, and his family has had to cover his lingering, you know, health costs. And he's now working in the oil fields near Odessa, Texas. And I talked to his mom, Valerie, and she's pretty worried about Kyle.
I worry about him. I wake up in the middle of the night dreaming that I walk in the door and he's hanging, or he shot himself because he's that depressed. You know, and then when basketball season comes around, oh, that's even worse.
And then I think it's also worth noting here that the majority of men's basketball and football players, the ones who are generating all of this money, are Black, while the majority of the people in power who are deciding whose scholarships get renewed are white.
And I think it's also worth saying, just to put some statistics behind that, more than 50% of college basketball and football players are Black.
And for the show, you talked about this with Washington Post sports columnist Kevin Blackistone, and he's done a lot of thinking about this. What did he tell you, Shira?
Yeah, well, Kevin Blackistone had some scathing criticism. Here's what he said.
Sets it up as a sort of plantation system where you have workers who work the crops that bring in all the revenue to the overseers. It may be a strong commentary, but I think it's an apt comparison.
Hmm. Yeah. And,
ouch.
Yeah, exactly. And from my reporting, I think that's pretty accurate because, again, we're getting back to that power and money imbalance. Because without the talent, without the players that people are going to pay to see in stadiums, without networks who are going to pay to see this talent compete, you're not bringing in the loads of money that these colleges are bringing in. And so I think, you know, it gives you some numbers for perspective. For tonight's game, the average ticket price, according to StubHub, has been $2,689. And that's not far off from the average Super Bowl ticket price. Exactly, you know, which ranges between or has ranged between $3,500 and $4,100. Now, college players get scholarships. NFL players make millions upon millions of dollars.
Yeah, and I think it's also interesting to see some of the other ways that, you know, race is caught up in this whole issue. There was a 2014 poll from the Washington Post and ABC News, which found that the majority of white respondents do not want to see college athletes getting paid a salary, whereas the majority of non-whites did, in fact, favor. 51% of non-whites favored seeing college athletes get paid. So you can see that race is really intertwined in this issue, both in terms of who's participating in these sports and then also how people view these issues.
So let's just back up a little bit. How did it get to this point? I mean, it certainly probably wasn't the intent of the NCAA to insist that college athletes stay amateur. So what happened?
Yeah, right. It's really interesting. You know, you'll hear a lot of people who want to keep the system the way it is, they support this idea of amateurism. They like the idea that the players are just doing this for the love of the game. And Only a Game senior producer Karen Given sort of looked into the roots of that. Where does this love for this amateur ideal come from? And what she found was that it sort of goes back a long way to sort of the Industrial Revolution. And what she found was around that time, you know, middle and upper class people were sort of worried that men were becoming soft. They no longer had to use their bodies for work as much. So they saw sort of sports as a way to preserve their strength. And that's how sort of football became intertwined with the higher education system. And the idea was, you know, these middle and upper class kids are going to play football to get this moral education. And they don't need any money. This is for moral reasons. And so, you know, it was all about just doing it for the love of the game. No one would get paid.
Oh, or it also gives them opportunities to make it to the pros, right?
That's
an argument as well, right?
I mean, that's a big argument and sort of a troubling argument and in some ways because families are kind of betting on their children when they gear, you know, their young lives towards success in football or success in basketball. And it's interesting because we also talked to Washington Post columnist Kevin Blackistone about this as well and the effect on families of this college sports culture, particularly on Black families. And here's what Blackistone said.
This is a issue that affects Black families more directly than anyone. When we see Black families putting so much emphasis on the athletic development of their children, particularly Black males, because they are lured by the athletic system at a very young age, it's a big, big problem.
So I wonder, you know, some other industries may make similar arguments that the workers obviously make much less than the executives, and there's a growing gap, right, between top management and the folks actually carrying out the work. This can be translated to a lot of different industries right now. So I'm wondering, what do folks say about changing that in the future and how that might change? Are athletes fighting for changes? I mean, what did you find out in your reporting?
Yeah, and I should say here, too, that, you know, there are a lot of college athletes who don't want the system to change. They say they're just happy getting their athletic scholarships. But then there does seem to be a growing number of athletes who do want to see the system change. So what are they doing? You know, there have been class action lawsuits, but that hasn't resulted in any major changes. You may remember the Northwestern football team tried to unionize a few years back, but that didn't work out. But there's one idea that people think really could make change, and that's a boycott. So I want you to imagine, you know, tonight's game, there are thousands of people at the stadium, ESPN is ready to broadcast it. But then imagine that the Alabama and Georgia players just decide not to play. They say, we're not going to play unless you guys give us a bigger piece of this pie. A lot of people think that could make a difference, but, you know, that's counting on these 18 to 22-year-olds to make a big personal sacrifice to just, you know, they've made it to the championship. I don't think it's very likely that they're just going to stay in the locker room and not play.
Yeah, and their livelihoods are potentially at stake because right. This is basically an audition for their NFL careers. I think a more likely scenario is that we're coming to a point where we're going to have to pay college players. And there have already been some people, some economists, some lawyers out there, some people who are deeply concerned with the future of college sports that are drawing up a business plan where players would get paid and seeing if they can find an investor to pay for that type of system and just put it out there as sort of a NCAA cartel busting idea. I don't know if their business plan will be the business plan that takes root, but I think sort of like the Olympics had to reckon with amateurism and the amateur ideal not working and not being feasible with all the money out there, NCAA is going to have to reckon with the amateur ideal and how it just is not a fit for where college sports is today with all the money flooding in.
Okay. Shira Springer and Martin Kessler talking about their reporting on college sports. You can find a link to the full hour Only a Game NCAA special program on our website. Shira, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Martin, thank you as well.
Thanks so much.
Twenty-four years ago this past weekend, women's figure skating champ and Stoneham native Nancy Kerrigan, who was dubbed America's skating sweetheart, was hurt by a man who whacked her legs with a police baton as she was leaving an ice rink. The ex-husband of her rival, skater Tanya Harding, was charged with hiring the man to attack Kerrigan. Harding was charged with interfering in the prosecution of the attack. And even today, this real-life tabloid story continues to get attention. This past weekend, also, the new movie retelling this story titled I, Tanya, won a Golden Globe Award for Best Supporting Actress. Joining us to talk about this is John Powers, the Olympics correspondent for the Boston Globe. He was at the event where Kerrigan was hurt, and he later saw Kerrigan and Harding compete in the Olympics. John, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm okay, thanks. This movie, I, Tanya, apparently is very sympathetic to Tanya Harding. In fact, she was at the Golden Globe Awards Sunday when Allison Janney, who played the role of Harding's mother in the movie, won for Best Supporting Actress. But remind us of Harding's career a bit. She was a very talented skater, yes?
She was. And I think if you look back, clearly she was on the wrong side of the tracks, if you will, the way that figure skaters were looked at back then. But she had an enormous amount of talent, and I think if you look back, probably Tanya got in her own way. Didn't train as hard as she needed to, but that said, she was still fourth in the 1992 Olympics, having arrived late and out of shape. So clearly she had the goods.
Mm-hmm. And what about compared to Kerrigan?
Basically, Nancy was a very solid skater, better all around, much more graceful, much more of an artist, looked better, if you will. Leggy, lithe, and I think that her personality was more used to what figure skating fans in the media were expecting, you know, from a country that had produced the Peggy Flemings and the Tenley Albrights and the Carol Heises.
So let's talk a little bit first, just in case folks don't remember, what happened specifically 24 years ago between Harding and Kerrigan. Kerrigan was hurt by a man when she was leaving the ice rink in Detroit, and Tonya Harding then issued a public apology. Let's listen to a clip of that.
I have devoted my entire life to one objective: winning an Olympic gold medal for my country. This is my last chance.
So I'm wondering, John, what was it like to cover this story and to see all of this as it was playing out?
In a word, it was bizarre. I was in Detroit. I was just finishing up a feature story on Nancy Kerrigan, because she was a local skater, that was going to run in the next day's Boston Globe. And sometimes your friends, your colleagues will play a prank on you. And someone said, hey, did you see that Nancy Kerrigan got whacked by a crowbar? And I said, ha, ha, ha. It turned out it was true. And then when we talked to Tonya at a press conference, I think the next day, and we were all joking, wouldn't it be interesting if Tonya had this thing all set up? So that's how it began for us.
And then, of course, we did find out that her ex-husband hired the man involved here.
Yeah, I think what was interesting is that, you know, you have a whole generation that's now grown up that wasn't around for that.
Right.
It's unclear how involved Tonya was in that, but clearly she had actually made the call to find out where Nancy Kerrigan was training. The hit was supposed to have been done on Cape Cod, but what they didn't know was that Nancy had already left for Detroit. Otherwise, that would have happened there. So certainly she was aware that something was going to happen to Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, after that, it was very awkward because it was kind of an appeals process. And it was such a mess. Both athletes ended up going to the Olympics. And it was a circus that I think hurt Nancy over there, because people in the Olympic level were so sick of the whole thing I think that there's no way they wanted an American woman to win a gold medal there.
Right. So Kerrigan won the silver, right?
Yes,
and
she did.
Harding came in eighth. And that must have been another zoo to cover that whole thing. Was that a difficult story?
It was. Well, also because Nancy was local. You know, there was intense interest in it in and around Boston. And I think that what happened was that there was so much uncertainty just going in from the U.S. team side. Will Nancy's knee come around enough where she can, you know, do a program? And will they throw Tonya off the team? So it turned out they did not throw Tonya off. And they did. And Nancy was, you know, well enough to jump. But what was really crazy was the first team practice over there. They had to literally practice together. Oof. Everyone by then knew that Tonya was involved in some way in this thing. And the rules were the whole team had to practice together at the same time. Mm. So that was, I mean, the circus never really ended here.
Right. You know, you mentioned class as an issue here. And I'm wondering, you know, Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding were from similar economic backgrounds, right?
You know, I think what's been, you know, now I think there's this kind of yin and yang concept where Nancy was the, you know, the privileged ice queen. Nancy's father was a welder who worked three jobs, including as a Zamboni driver in the rink.
To get her lessons.
To let her skate.
Right.
So it was not as though Nancy, Nancy had these silver skates. You know, I don't think she needed to. I mean, she clearly didn't have the troubled background that Tonya did. But it was not unusual then. Many of the women who were competing then came from working class backgrounds. Nicole Bobek never knew her father. Holly Cook didn't have a whole lot of money. It was not unusual for working class women to be in contention for the team.
But do you think there is this, it still is image conscious about class dynamics and about having this leggy princess as opposed to someone a little rougher looking? I mean, is it still like that in figure skating, would you say?
I think it is. It is probably a bit less like that now. Hmm. Also, I don't think that Tonya helped her image. I mean, she was well known for driving trucks, drinking, smoking, and shooting pool. And, you know, that said, she was a national champion. She won in 1991. And I think had she softened those edges a little bit, she could have gotten endorsements. And if she trained a little more, She could have kept her title, and she could have been the Ice Queen going into 1992, as opposed to Chrissy Yamaguchi, who ended up winning the gold.
Why do you think this story continues to fascinate us? I heard, I read, actually, it described as being reality TV before there was reality TV.
Exactly. And I think looking at now, looking at some of the themes in American society, she's a more sympathetic figure in that, especially with the whole sexual assault theme. She was assaulted by her half-brother. She was beaten by her ex-husband. Her mother was very abusive to her. Also, I think there's certainly a have and have not theme in America now. And many, many Americans will identify with Tanya's story. You know, many people who voted for Trump who said, you know, you won't be ignored anymore. You won't be passed over anymore. A lot of Americans feel looked down upon, marginalized. So I think to them, I think, you know, Tanya is a more sympathetic figure than she would have been in 1994.
John Powers, Olympics correspondent for the Boston Globe. John, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.